friends and listeners. Thank you for stopping by. I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, and this is Red Eyes Radio. We are an independent radio program dedicated to the examination of many different topics, but we especially look at subversive groups, mass media lies, and also the double standards and the hypocrisy of the political system and the establishment, especially in the West, as the elite push for the eradication of our traditions, our cultures, really who we are, and we look at what methods they're using to achieve their goals. You can check us out if you're new to the program at redeyescreations.com for more radio, videos, news, and much more. We also have redeyesradio.net directly to the radio archive. Paul Gottfried has been one of America's leading intellectual historians and paleoconservative thinkers for over 40 years. He is the author of many books, including Conservatism in America, The Strange Death of Marxism, After Liberalism, Multiculturalism, and the Politics of Guilt, also Leo Strauss and the Conservative Movement in America. He has been a staunch critic of the neoconservative movement. He has warned against the growing lack of distinctions between the Democratic and Republican parties and the rise of the managerial state. He is Professor Emeritus of Humanities at Elizabethtown College and a Guggenheim recipient. He joins us today to begin our discussion on the recent attacks in Paris and the Charlie Hebdo shootings, and we'll also talk more about the future of America and the future of Europe. Welcome, Paul Gottfried. Thank you so much for coming on the program with us. Hope you're doing well today.
Yes, I am.
Great. Excellent. Glad to hear it. Now, I think we've caught you at an interesting time considering some of the topics I wanted to talk with you about today. And I think we should begin with the shootings in Paris. This is hot off the presses, of course. And I know that there are a lot of people that view this differently. Some see this as a reaction to the intervention policies that the neoconservatives and in the extension NATO have applied in the Middle East. Others see this as a full-on, you know, false flag event that, you know, these people had ties to the intelligence services and were known by, you know, respective governments created by them. But at the very least, it seems to me in a way that this has been welcomed by these players as they're jumping on this as an opportunity to expand even further. But at the very least, I think that we can recognize that the Charlie Hebdo shootings is something that has been enabled and is now even remotely plausible and made believable only due to the multicultural ethic that the establishment have been pushing on Europe for many, many decades now. I mean, think about it. If we didn't have the demographic situation that we do in France, none of this would, of course, be plausible or even be, you know, happening. So how do you view what happened in France, Paul, and why do you think it happened?
Well, what I see in happening in Paris, particularly with this demonstration yesterday, there was some Frenchman conservative who said, "Je n'irai aucunement à la messe." I certainly am not going to the mass. What it was a highly ritualized demonstration of support for the system. I don't think anything is going to change as a result of this. The Charlie Hebdo Mail is an utterly contemptible scatological magazine, which specializes in degrading traditional religious symbols, and not only Islamic holy figures, but also Christian holy figures. It is a magazine of the cultural and social left, which, among other positions that it has taken over the years, has called for the banning of the Front National, which is the only party in France that I know of that has openly come out against Islamic immigration, which is, of course, at the heart of the problem. So actually what you have is the establishment wants to have its cake and eat it at the same time. They want to have multiculturalism. They want more Muslims to come into the country. Anyone who criticizes this will be attacked as an advocate of Auschwitz. There's absolutely no way you're going to stop yourself. And, of course, the neoconservatives in the United States have an additional agenda, which is to make common cause with the Israelis against the Muslim or Islamo-fascist danger. So this comes in very handy for them.
Yeah.
All of the people who are complaining about how terrible this was, support censorship. They are quite happy to censor those who deny the Armenian Holocaust, the Nazi Holocaust, They have signed petitions in many cases, in the case of the intellectuals in France, to ban the Nouvelle École, or the Nouvelle Droite, Nouvelle Droite, rather, which is the group around Alain de Benoist. They're absolute liars and hypocrites. The French have a word, tartufferie. They're hypocrites about everything that they're doing. And I try not to watch it because I'm an old man and I don't want to drop dead of a heart attack at this point.
Well, I understand you because you're absolutely right. This has been a tremendous ritual. We saw the same thing really after Breivik 2 in Norway. It mimics that very much in terms of how everyone came out of the streets, and it was very much this, we won't be silenced and we're not going to be afraid and all that. But as you say, this is a fraud. You know, France tooting free speech when, as you say, they've been, you know, cracking down on certain people for years, and Le Pen and everyone who, let's say, even brings up in questionings the Holocaust or something like that. And so they're not really for free speech. That's not what this is about.
Well, they are for free speech for the far left, and for its right to engage in pornography and to degrade Christian symbols. Finally, I would add that it is one thing for in the United States to show tolerance of the kind that I hear Fox News bragging about, that we're allowed to suspend the Virgin Mary in dung and then have the state pay for it. That's the tolerance. If one were to try to do this to the most sacred figure in American mythology, Martin Luther King, only heavens knows what would befall the blasphemer.
Yeah.
It is highly selective tolerance that we show. Christianity is utterly despised, therefore you can step all over it. And we'll applaud you. We'll say, you know, that this is free speech. If you were to go against anything that is politically correct, you would suffer terrible professional and social consequences.
Absolutely. You're right. You're spot on about that. And it's very hypocritical. It's double standards all over the place, but they don't seem to see that. And I think one of the reasons for this is because it very much has turned into, you know, you call it liberal internationalism. It's very much turned into a religion. It's the new religion, basically.
Yes, it is. Political correctness is the religion of the 21st century in the West and Western countries, and those countries that have fallen under American influence.
Now, what's interesting here as well is that you, as a, I guess, you know, paleoconservative, you're definitely outside of the regular view of what people today would view as conservative, especially neoconservative. We can talk more about them later, but it's interesting here how they are immediately jumping on the situation. And again, as a preface, I said before, you might view this as a false flag or as a extension to the policies that have occurred, what have you. But nonetheless, however you view that, it's clear that they're taking and jumping on this opportunity to even broaden their expansionist ideology, let's say, in the Middle East, their military intervention. But is that a smart idea here? I mean, let's think about this. So, because have we gotten more or less terrorism in the world since this time? Is this not just going to exacerbate the problem?
Well, I'm not sure that it is a bad idea from, you know, a neoconservative vantage point. They have total control over the conservative movement in the United States. They get all of these evangelicals and others excited when they start talking about Islamofascism and standing up for human rights. It's a kind of win-win situation because anyone who would question them from the right would be immediately marginalized, the way I've been marginalized and other people have been marginalized. Now, the question is there excitement about this going to cause, you know, more terrorism? I don't know. This could be, you know, part of the blowback in the end. I'm not sure it has to be. I mean, right now they're focusing not so much on the Middle East, they're focusing on Europe. Their position is they'd like to see some way by which the Muslim population can be educated, that is turned into neoconservatives or believe neoconservative ideology. They have not taken a position really against immigration, even for Muslims.
No.
They just warn against, you know, letting too many Islamicists in or people who are anti-Zionist or something like that. So I'm not sure whether this has really any immediate implications for the Middle East.
Right. Now, let's define a little bit here of what you mean with the, or, or how you view the neoconservatives, because this is an important point as well, that they basically are an extension to, I think you refer to them basically as a kind of a new form of Jacobinism. It's about exporting the democratic liberal values as they see it to the rest of the world. And this is what the so-called, you know, conservative movement have turned into, and there's nothing traditional about it anymore, really, correct?
No, no, but I think what you see in the case of the neoconservatives is a kind of perfect, the French of a word, recouvrement. There's a kind of just overlap between the neoconservatives and traditional American evangelicals, mid-American Republicans. They seem to be resonate very well with the Republican base. And also with Protestant evangelicals. And I find this remarkable because if you look at the neoconservatives, they all seem to be of the same kind. They come from at least I think would be a very parochial Eastern European Jewish background from large cities. They bring with them a lot of baggage, prejudices against certain groups, even a certain kind of a certain kind of provincialism in dealing with people who are unlike themselves.
Right.
Yet the ideas that they put forward, which are obviously self-serving ideas, have enormous resonance across the United States. When they talk about human rights, or that Martin Luther King's a conservative, or that America was founded to bring equality and their version of human rights to the rest of the world, most self-described conservatives and most self-described Republicans buy into all of this. Some as you wonder, I mean, why does Hitler, who brought with him, again, it's sort of his own baggage, came from an Austrian provincial background, you know, why did he do so well with the German public? Seems to be at certain historical conjunction, certain historical junctures, a coming together of attitudes, ambitions, values between groups that you would not think have very much in common. And for years I've emphasized the provincialism of the neoconservatives. It's obvious that they've captured the entire American right, that they are adored by the evangelicals in the United States. They get to run our foreign policy no matter what political party is in power. And, you know, the question you have to ask yourself is why is there this this very deep resonance that they have among the Americans?
Well, exactly. That is a good point. And how do you see that this is developing? That are they just going to continue on the same, you know, trail and believe that they're going to get American? Because they say they're very influential when it comes to foreign policy. We do have AIPAC as a very strong lobbying force here on where to go in that capacity. But how are they doing back home, though? I mean, it seems like the Democrats are going to be the leading party from here on out. I might be wrong on that. I'm not sure. But I think that partially has to do with the changing demographics of America, too.
Well, the Democrats might win the presidential race, in which case the neoconservatives will take over with Hillary Clinton, who many of them are already backing. If they get their candidate in the Republican Party, who's, you know, like one of three candidates that they could totally control, Jeb Bush, Mitt Romney, if he comes back into the race, and Chris Christie, if he gets back into the race, Huckabee will certainly be able to control, who will run as some kind of evangelical, but will really be a neocon. One person they probably could not control entirely is Rand Paul, but even there, I suspect they would have influence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ted Cruz sounds like a neocon whenever he talks about foreign policy. I don't see how they can possibly lose. I mean, I discovered that Victoria Nuland, who is one of the point people for Obama in foreign policy, is married to Robert Kagan.
That's right. Yep.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, and she's been meddling in Ukraine affairs heavily, as we have learned, you know. Yeah.
Right, exactly.
So the bigger question, of course, though, is, you know, there isn't really that much difference in American politics if we look at the so-called conservative force that exists there, because they are, I think you said this elsewhere, they're basically trying to play catch up to things that the left has implemented many, many years ago. And now they've adopted those as their own values and saying, yeah, this is where we stand. It's not really, yeah. It's kind of an empty direction. It's not, it's leaderless in that capacity, correct?
That's exactly the case. But also the conservative movement takes what are leftist positions and claim them as quintessential American values. I mean, if they're old enough, they become the tradition. Like, you know, should we have a Voting Rights Act for blacks? Well, that's the American tradition. Gay marriage will soon be a conservative tradition. I mean, they simply absorb whatever the left has done. The distinctive feature is the belligerence in foreign policy, like the Jacobin or Menshevik or Trotskyist belligerence, because it's always belligerence that is shown in the name of leftist values.
Yeah, it's kind of a... It lines up with Bolshevism to a certain extent on certain issues, doesn't it?
Yeah, yes, it does. No, I mean that, you know, I've argued that by the end of the Cold War, the neoconservatives who were running our side sounded more leftist than the Soviets.
Yeah, wow. And that has to do with coming out of the anti-communist movement, that they saw a way to defeat that was actually to bring that particular flavor to the table.
I think there's more. No, I think the... they were anti-communist because they saw the communists as fascist or as right-wing.
Ah, yeah.
I mean, I think they're basically extreme left-wing deviationist. You know, they're sort of like the followers of Babeuf and the French Revolution who break from the Hébertist or the Jacobins or whatever because they're even more radical. But in this case, they'll end up taking over the right, which is even more remarkable.
Yes, it is. And of course, in that capacity, then you don't have a true opposition to what's happening in the world. And in whatever direction you go, at least in American politics, I mean, we can talk about Europe a little bit later. That has a different thing to it now happening politically. But in America, at least, it doesn't matter where you go. You're going to get the same results at the end of the day.
Well, they do try to differentiate their product a bit. For instance, if you get a Republican, they won't push... for recruiting minorities quite as hard, or they may not give in to all the feminist demands at the same time, or something like that. But they're obviously moving in the same direction. There is no difference. Also, I think the Republicans are more likely to be flag wavers. They appeal to patriotism, but that's usually done in order to advance some kind of belligerence.
Yeah, exactly. So let's go back to Europe for a little bit here and talk a little bit more about multiculturalism, because this is such a huge topic. And you wrote about this in a book called Multiculturalism and the Politics of Guilt, subtitled Towards a Secular Theocracy. And that kind of goes in line with what we said before, that this is about a creation of a new religion. But they basically believe that they can continue on the path that they're doing in Europe, you know, for example, bringing in more Muslims, about making them, let's say, secular and somehow adapting them. And again, it's reflective of their desire to break down any kind of traditionalist values, correct?
Yes, it is. Now, what is interesting about this is that the idea of westernizing non-Western people, for instance, Muslims who are usually non-Western, was rather limited in the past. For instance, I was in Jordan about 12 years ago, and I noticed there were women who were in professions, they were Muslims, they weren't extremely Orthodox Muslims, and they held roughly the same attitudes as the women, you know, of my mother's generation that I used to listen to in the 1950s. I mean, they were very, you know, pretty much the same. They believed in traditional marriage, having families, et cetera, et cetera. What you get is feminism, gay rights, transgendered rights, all this other stuff that gets thrown into the mixture, so that in order to become Western, you have to become even more radicalized or even more alienated from your traditional communal values. So, I mean, it's even harder to Westernize people, given what the West is now interpreted to mean, than was the case 60 or 70 years ago, when Westernization required much less change.
So how do they manage to pull this off? Let's talk about the politics of guilt. And I think that Europeans and Americans have, of course, spearheaded all of these things, and they've fallen for this lie in a particular way that none other so far have done. So what's the politics of guilt?
Well, it is what I argue in my book on multiculturalism, and also in several of my other books, is that the multiculturalism builds on a certain kind of Christian, more specifically Protestant mindset. It is one that is, you know, starts out being concerned with metaphysical guilt becomes social guilt. And it is social guilt that weighs on the individual in what has become an atomized society. And in this atomized society, one is taught that there are certain groups that have been the victims of Western Christian white male society, whatever, bourgeois society. Anti-colonialism, is, at least in Europe, I think, provides the momentum for what seems to be the first phase of the politics of guilt. And this sort of goes on, and colonialism is seen as the great evil of the 20th century, from which all these third world people suffer. The Holocaust, of course, then comes in and is blamed not on evil Nazis, but on Christian society. And everyone is guilty of the Holocaust. Everyone has a hand in it. Even countries that fought against Hitler were really supporting the mass murder of Jews and Gypsies or whatever. So this is the second phase. In the United States, of course, what fuels the politics of guilt, at least in its early phase, is racism. And if you read the work by Gunnar, your countryman, Gunnar Myrdal, on the American Dilemma, it's all about how we have a history of racism that we have to atone for.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, Gunnar Myrdal, the gentleman behind the concept of folkhemmet, I believe. He was very instrumental in that.
Right, he was, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. At earlier phase, he was a fascist nationalist, and so was his wife. And then they sort of become pretty standard leftists later on. And talk about, you know, how racism is an American burden. So this sort of adds to the politics of guilt. And the religious culture that seems to move most strongly toward this in America certainly are the Protestants, because the mainstream Protestant churches pretty much lose their theological substance and their social base. Protestantism becomes more and more associated with the individual seeking some kind of redemption in a world that has lost meaning, but a world in which certain traditional Christian attitudes remain, guilt being one of them. But it's no longer guilt or unworthiness or sinfulness before the Creator, but social guilt. And this becomes more and more directed toward the sins of racism, anti-Semitism, then sexism, homophobia, all these other things. And what I argue is that this becomes a dominant ideology, the sort of ideology of guilt, since the 1960s. It is really based in the United States, but because of America's growing sphere of influence, it comes to characterize or shape other cultures, other Western cultures as well. But it seems to be, again, sort of strongest in Protestant countries, Germanic countries, in fact. And of course, in the case of the Germans, they really had it, you know, imposed on them after World War II in the form of re-education.
Oh, absolutely.
They feel guilty about their fascist past. But Germany is the laboratory, you know, in which the politics of guilt is, you know, tried out. Together, of course, with the authoritarian personality ideology of the Frankfurt School, which becomes basic to this enterprise, that becomes a kind of pseudo-scientific way of measuring prejudice about which we are to feel guilty. It's almost seen as a kind of metaphysical defect or biological defect in certain. Certain cultures or certain ethnicities, particularly Northern European Christian societies, and rather than abate over time, it seems to become stronger and stronger. And I've noticed in the case of the United States that, you know, all of these sort of liberal Republicans and WASP you run into. People like the Bush family have been full of this, and not only of noblesse oblige, they've been full of the politics of guilt for generations. Southerners certainly are. The Southern whites exhibit this quality. In the case of the Germans, I don't even know what to think anymore, because they're so over the top that I think it may have to do with German authoritarian personality. I mean, they run to blame themselves for everything in history, even wars that other people started up, they blame themselves for.
Right.
And I think that their exhibitions of the politics of guilt seems to be pathological. But, you know, in the case of the Swedes, I don't know. I don't know much. I've been in Sweden.
I'd say to a certain extent it's even worse there, because it's less hands-on. It's been less since we've been drawn into the physical conflicts in a less capacity. It's turned into more of a mental and psychological warfare in Sweden, and in that capacity they have been the laboratory. I've talked about that on many past programs. So the climate is absolutely horrible. I mean, it's after Germany, I'd say it's the country that's right in the heels. When it comes to, for example, immigration, we're even worse. As a small country, we got the gold medal, world championship winners for allowing in most refugees from around the world, and we're heading
you're Germanic Protestant. That's part of the explanation. But they've also blamed themselves because they didn't declare war on Nazi Germany.
Exactly. Exactly.
I mean, why would you get involved in a war like that?
Yeah. It's remarkable.
But even the Norwegians who fought the Nazis are made to feel guilty. They didn't do enough to fight them
something
like that.
The Danes too, you know. So it doesn't matter if any of this is really true or not. This is something that's being used against us. And people born today are to repent for the sins of their fathers, kind of an original sin of sorts, which lines up here again with the religious idea here. But the question is, of course, is where this is going, because it's getting so absurd now, specifically when it comes to targeting, you know, white people and what they call white privilege. And they even have conferences of these now. They're forcing kids to wear these little white armbands to remind themselves of how guilty they are. I wouldn't be surprised if they turn up and say that, you know, despite denying race, they're going to say that this is somehow genetically inclined or something within us that it's at fault, right? I mean, this could go either way at this point.
Well, my observation about this is that people will go as far as the system requires, because human beings are conformist. This is why they survive in society. I think, as Nicholas Wade and other sociobiologists have pointed out, that you know we want to go with the flow. We don't want to stand out too much, and that, you know, on the whole, this is a good thing. You know, for there are aggregate benefits, even if it makes everybody seem to be unprincipled and so forth. The problem, of course, is that at a certain point, the problems arising from the acceptance of these crazy attitudes may be so high, the cost may be so high, that people may be forced to rethink or think for the first time about them. And I always like to say that, you know, if given a choice between Jeb Bush and Al Sharpton, I will vote for Al Sharpton every time. And the reason is, you want to bring on a crisis. You want to force people to think about what they're saying,
right?
You know, and the attitudes they're accepting. And as long as the system just sort of moves along incrementally, or there's slow increments, and your standard of living isn't that disastrously affected, people will go on saying crazy things. And even behaving in a crazy way, at least ritualistically. The question is, what do you do if this craziness begins to affect your standard of living or your safety?
Right.
I mean, what do you do at that point?
Exactly. Pushed out of your comfort zone. So you take the view that the worse it gets, the quicker, to a certain extent, the better is going to get.
Absolutely. Yeah. As I tell people, I'm a right-wing Leninist. I totally buy that argument.
Exactly. I mean, I tend to agree with you, but then at the same time, that does feel like a kind of a part of me feel that, it's defeatist. You know, we should work to try to salvage what's there, but then the next day I'm like, that's it. It's all over. Let's let it go. Let's just bring it on quicker, right? The collapse.
But my position is, if there is a real choice to be made, I will make that choice. For instance, I would be very happy to vote for Marine Le Pen in France, although I disagree. I don't think she's conservative enough for my taste, but, you know, she is half a glass of water is better than no water at all. But, you know, in the United States, one is forced to pick, choose between two utterly repulsive leftist candidates, both of whom are simply going to go with the flow, and will do absolutely nothing to improve the system. And, you know, at that point, I'm quite happy to vote for somebody who'll be a game changer, to use that phrase.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think all we have to do to realize the true opposition in this question is to look at how the media are treating the only parties in Europe now that actually offer up any kind of opposition to the European Union, that actually are, they're trying to look after, to a certain extent at least, the welfare of the European people in the native countries that they were born in. And the media, bar none, is attacking them all over the board.
Right.
But at the same time, they are attracting more and more voters because people, they see the reality of what is happening within their countries. And I think that they don't like it, whether they admit that to themselves or not.
And very often the choices are not as right-wing as the media would like us to believe.
Exactly.
I mean,
yeah.
The Alternative für Deutschland is hardly a far-right party. They sound like American rhinos. The Swedish Democrats, some of whom I know, just sort of sound like moderate conservatives, as far as I can tell. But they somehow are seen as outsiders or as moral lepers because they don't go along with the system entirely. Someone like Orban in Hungary, I admit, is a right winger. There have been attempts by the American government to see what they can do to remove him from power, to place pressure on the Hungarians. Needless to say, if he were some communist apparatchik who became a social democrat and supported gay rights, they'd be entirely on his side.
Yeah.
I mean, it's any deviation from the right that is immediately attacked by the system.
Let's just talk a little bit about what you say is the fundamental difference between the right and the left, and specifically egalitarianism or equality. I think that you draw back everything to that point, correct?
Right. Well, I mean, there's egalitarianism, I think, is perhaps the other value is universalism. And I would say both of these values are unthinkable without Christianity. It's not that Orthodox Christians necessarily believe this. We can find this in Martin Luther or John Calvin. But what it is to say is that unless you had a Christian civilization that emphasized these values in some way, I don't see how these leftist values would resonate so deeply in Western societies. But I think those are the core values of the left. And this is not to say that all leftist positions are the same. I mean, you can have, you know, traditional socialist, Marxist, Leninist who want economic transformation, who want government ownership of the means of production. But we have now is something else, which is what I describe as cultural Marxism, which is based on social engineering aimed at destroying the remnants of a bourgeois white Christian society. And using immigration, using educational indoctrination, and using censorship, out-and-out censorship in some cases, as means by which this kind of egalitarian vision can be realized.
An interesting thing here, contradiction perhaps, is that within the Soviet Union and the satellite state that they went to kind of absorb, have, interestingly enough, been actually shielded from cultural Marxism. This took root in the West, and I think that that's why we see these more traditionalist values, conservative values, actually existing in Russia today, for example.
Oh, exactly. Now, for one thing, I think the Soviet communism was inherently more conservative than Western liberalism. And the other thing is, you're right, they were shielded from this sort of the ectoplasm of the, you know, the culture of Western media and educational elites. It's never reached them. I know people in Poland and Hungary and Ukraine and Russia. And when you talk about homosexual marriage being a Western value, they think you're crazy. Communists would have taken homosexuals and put them in prison. So I mean, that this is totally incomprehensible to someone who lived under communism.
Now, there's one thing I want to ask you about here, and it pertains to these different victim groups and victim classes. Now, do you think that they, at the top of all this, the establishment, the elite, the powers that be, wherever you want to call them, actually are there to look out for the interests of many of these, you know, groups and various, you know, identities, whatever, what have you, that's out there? Or are they just using these as a tool? Are they piggybacking their own political issues on all these victim classes?
Well, this was the argument that Sam Francis, who was a close friend of mine, and I had for about 30 years, because he would have accepted the second position unconditionally, that elites simply manipulate certain symbols and ideas to gain power and then to maintain themselves in power, that they do not necessarily believe these things, and they're sort of cynical in the way they use these ideas. And I used to always accuse Sam of being a Marxist, saying that, you know, he believes that the actors are all rational and that there are material causes that explain their behavior. my view, I think, is perhaps a bit more complex. I think that Sam's explanation is not entirely false. I mean, obviously, there are people who benefit enormously from multicultural teachings and from stepping forward as defenders of blacks and gays and so forth. And, you know, I think they do it for this. But I would go beyond that. There are also minority groups, like Jews, like many Asians, who are highly intelligent but feel uncomfortable living in a white Christian society, and who ally themselves with radical forces in order to create a social order in which they feel more comfortable. So I think that's another factor that we can look at. But I think at the end of the day, elites are in fact influenced by the ideas they represent. I do not think that Hillary Clinton tomorrow is going to change, even if there's no way I can test this. This proposition, obviously, but you know, this is my conjecture, that there's no way that she would be able to change her views and become, you know, like Viktor Orban in Hungary or Vladimir Putin in Russia, because she, you know, sees the signs of the time are changing. She is very much committed to a leftist feminist agenda. That's you know, she's staked her life on this. I don't think she could change any more than Pat Buchanan could change and become a leftist, or I could change and become a leftist. So, you know, I think elites believe their ideology. Now, they may not act consistently on the basis of the ideology, but they do believe it, at least to some degree. I mean, it's like, you know, you say, was Henry VIII a devout Catholic? He wasn't a Roman Catholic. He was an Anglo-Catholic in the end. But, yes, he was a Catholic. I mean, He may have practiced adultery. He may have violated all seven of the deadly sins at the same time, as far as I know. But he also tried to enforce clerical celibacy, the seven sacraments of the Church of Rome. You know, same for Charles V, the Holy Roman Emperor this time. And people just don't behave consistently, but that doesn't mean that they don't believe in the ideas they profess.
True, very, very true. So would you say that, you know, because we've had largely homogenous societies throughout history, and now we've seen a tremendous population, not only displacement, but migrations. We've seen thousands of, different insecure minorities that feel displaced in particularly, as you say, European and Western societies. And now somehow it's those homogenous societies that are to blame. They are the the erroneous factor in the image, and they need to kind of be displaced and dissolved for everyone else to feel correct at ease, I guess. But I mean, this is insanity of how they managed to pull this off. I'm still grappling with the idea of how quickly this has gone. We've had thousands of years of different societies and cultures and our own traditions, and today virtually in Europe, nothing of this is left.
Well, you know, I have this long essay that I wrote in for Ron Unz's review last week, and it was a response to Phil Giraldi, who was very critical of Israel. He worked for the State Department, and one of his criticisms of Israel is that it is based on ethnic homogeneity. That's one of the principles of the state. And we in the United States do not believe in ethnic homogeneity. And what I responded is, what is wrong with Israel believing that it's an ethnic nation state?
Yeah, I agree.
It's an ethnic nation state. Now, that doesn't mean that American Jews who support Israel have a right to tell the United States that we should be multiculturalist.
Exactly.
I mean, you have to be consistent about this. And the late Al Sherman, who's an English Jew, made a comment that because he believes in an Anglo-Saxon England, he believes in a Jewish state or something. I mean, you know, people do have a right to maintain their traditional ethnic identities, religious identities, as long as they don't go around trampling on other people. That's fine. But, you know, why should the United States be committed to ethnic diversity except in the case of Israel?
Exactly. That's the double standards. And then, you know, facing reality, for example, in Sweden, we have a lady called Barbara Spector, who's she's Jewish, and she's working to actively, she's getting government funds for, she's up in Stockholm, an organization called Paideia, and she's actively saying that her task is to, you know, make Europe multicultural, that it won't survive if it doesn't go in this path. And on top of it, she says that Jews are responsible for this action. And so my question back has always been, well, wait a minute. You know, it's like there's one application to this for, let's say, Israel, because she's Israeli. She made Aliyah a while back or whatever. So she can, you know, she is Israeli. She can go there. But instead, she's sitting in Stockholm in Sweden and actively are trying to disrupt the homogeneity of Swedes, you know. And this is what really makes me pissed off at the situation. It's like, you know, it's one application for certain people and another for another. And it seems to me, Paul, if we look at this objectively, that none of the societies in the world right now are as targeted on this question as the European and the Western societies. Would you agree with
that? Right. But the question is, why would Swedes even listen to this crazy Jewish woman?
Well, they don't even know who she is. The point being, I think she's lobbying more behind the scenes, I'd say, and how influential she is, that can be debated, of course, too. Mm-hmm. But the fact is she is there and she's getting government funds to do these things.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm always responding to this. Someone will say, well, it's all the fault of Jews or blacks or this group. Well, my question is, why does the majority go along with these idiotic ideas?
I agree, exactly. What's the fault there? Why are people so subservient to these ideas? Why do they fall for the either if it's propaganda, subversive ideas, whatever, it's something within us that causes us to fall for the ideas. So you're right. So is you mentioned Christianity before, kind of springboarding from that. Was this the path towards ruin for, let's say, the European people, the Western people? I mean, if the Frankfurt School have worked in a kind of a psychological nature with conditioning and things like that, they managed to bring in some of these ideas through Christianity, perhaps. But was that the path to ruin, do you think?
Well, I don't know. You have these neo-pagan Nietzscheans on the right, especially in the European right. That I come across, and I'm very amused by them because they seem to believe that although Christianity has been the dominant religion in one form or another throughout Western society for several thousand years, one can now just slough it off and go back to becoming neo-pagans. And of course, their views of paganism are so weird and so anachronistic that no ancient pagan would ever have recognized what they considered to be paganism. I think that the Western world really has no other religious cultural alternative but to remain Christian at this point. I mean, there's nothing else that I can see them becoming. Certainly not Celts or adopting some ancient Nordic religion. I mean, you may want to work these themes into your worldview somehow, but they cannot, in my opinion, replace the very, very deeply established Christian identity of the West. The problem is that Christianity itself has been totally corrupted by cultural Marxism. I mean, the two have become indistinguishable. I mean, the kind of thing the communists tried to do with, let's say, the German Lutheran Church, and did very successfully, by the way, because the Evangelische Kirche des Deutschlands is, in fact, a radical leftist church. But you know, it's cultural Marxist now. It is, but it was probably communist before. You can do this with state churches, but the cultural Marxists seem to be extremely successful in taking them over. And by the way, in the case of state churches, there is a disadvantage because whoever, whatever leftist is running the government then can control the church. And that is obviously a problem in Sweden.
Well, exactly, It's state intervention. And this is something I want to talk more about in the second segment here as we're going to take a break in a little bit here. But just that the state is something that ultimately enables this and actually works towards that. I want to get your take on how to, of course, dismantle some of these things and begin to move in a sound direction again. And just a quick note on the paganism issue. I think it's for a lot of people, it's not as much going back, 1500 years as it is to move forward and adapting to the circumstances that we find ourselves in today. I think anyone who has a brain would recognize that you can't just push the reverse button and then everything would be great. You have to learn from your past. You have to recognize what you have, I think, in your traditional roots and then kind of create something new, but it's, based in something that is based on heredity and our ancient past. So that's my two cents on that anyway. But let's talk about some of your websites, Paul. I want you to give out some of the titles to your books so people who want to read more from you, read more about your work, where they can go to pick up copies and give us some of the titles as well.
Right. I should say that I have been blacklisted by the mass media in the United States for about the last 40 years. Despite that fact, my books are published by very prestigious publishing houses. Princeton published my book After Liberalism in 1999. Cambridge published my book on Leo Strauss and the American conservative movement 2 years ago. Macmillan published several editions of my books on the conservative movement. University presses like University of Missouri, Fordham University Press, published my more scholarly works. The book on multiculturalism is available in about 10 different languages now. It hardly got reviewed in the United States because, as I said, I've been declared some kind of dangerous or unhinged thinker, but it is available in Polish, Russian, German, Spanish. My book on the strange death of European Marxism is now being translated to Swedish. And as I like to tell my wife, that after I'm gone, there'll be many people reading me in languages other than English. I doubt I'll be read in English, however.
Oh, really?
reading me in English will be a kind of exotic practice. I do write for websites, and I've been writing most often recently for Ron Unz Review. I wrote a number of articles for Tacky Mag and the American Conservative magazine, some of which are available in a book called A War and Democracy. In fact, it was brought out by Arctos Press, which I think is based in Stockholm.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Right. So I also write in German, occasionally in French, but more often in German, and I write for Neue Ordnung, which comes out in Graz in Austria. And they also are the ones who publish the German translations of my works.
All right, there's a couple of websites that are obviously we're going to have linked up on redicecreations.com, so you can click through easily from there. But you have a personal website. You said you're not doing it anymore that much, but people can find all the book titles there. It's paulgottfried.net.
Right. If you simply go on Wikipedia, there is a reference. Also, I know my friend Ron Unz, who runs the review and is a brilliant computer engineer and a mathematician, has compiled a list of all of my popular essays. I've also written many scholarly essays. These are essays that I wrote about current events. And if you can access his website, he has a. In fact, you just go on Unz Review, and then he has an archive for me. And I think there's 500 or 600 articles to which the reader would have access.
Very good. It's simply unz.com, UNZ.com. We'll have that linked up there as well. And a number of other ones, as you mentioned, Tacky Mag, Arctos, the H.L. Mencken Club as well. You're the president of that at the moment?
I am the president for life, I think, of the H.L. Mencken Club, which is a conservative organization. It's we like to think of ourselves as part of the non-aligned or disaligned right. I noticed that most of our members are at least over by now over 60. They're corporate lawyers, professors, we have quite a few physicians. And we meet once a year in Baltimore. We're named for the sage of Baltimore, H.L. Mencken, who was a famous conservative iconoclastic journalist of the 1920s and 1930s.
All right, very good. A lot there for people to dig into. Check out the links on our website. But we'll continue this conversation right after the break. So stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Paul, and we'll be right back. And stay with us as we continue in the second hour for our members to talk about what to do about the problem. We examine the big enabler, the state, and the various political parties, none of which seems to have any focus on preserving cultural values. We discuss the war on human nature, immigration rates, the assimilation of radical and hostile populations, and the reformation of democracy. Later, we go into the increasing emasculation of Western man, the priesthood of the managerial class, and the hierarchy of victims and victimizers. Don't miss it as we continue on redicemembers.com, our members' website. Go there to sign up and tune in. We have tons of shows for you there waiting in the pipeline. We have also more coming, of course, with Tom Goodridge, Dennis Fetcho, Octavian, and Eric Karlstrom, to name a few. But do stay with us. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening.